We have three outstanding speakers that will help us understand and navigate public opinion, what this election is about, why it's important, and I'm hoping we'll do a little predicting at the end of the conversation, and we'll see on Sunday if our predictions came true or if they did not. So without further ado, let me begin by introducing Bruce Stokes. Bruce is the director of Global Economic Attitudes in the Pew Research Center's Global Attitudes Project. And Bruce has just released a very new Pew survey, surveying seven EU nations on the eve of the European Parliament elections and gathering their mood. And so Bruce is going to do a presentation based on that survey work. I believe you were in Europe last week announcing those results. So this is the Washington rollout of this very important, and I would say, almost conflicting survey. It's both positive and there's some challenges in there. And so Bruce is going to give us that overview of that new survey. And then we're going to invite our other two panelists up to help give us some perspectives about European attitudes and what's at stake. We have Olaf Bünke, who is the head of the Berlin office in the European Council on Foreign Relations. He has served previously as a senior foreign and European policy advisor to the Bundestag from 2009 and 2011. And I just will pause here. Olaf is brought to us by our fantastic partnership with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. We have had a long-standing series about Germany in Europe, and this is a wonderful partnership with Pia Baumgartner, who is the executive director. We're going to let Pia say a few words at the close out. But Pia is saying farewell to Washington, and I just wanted to give a moment of great gratitude for her stalwart support of the U.S.-German relationship. So thank you, Pia, and thank you to the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung for this partnership. So Olaf's going to take a step back, give us the perspective from Berlin, but looking at a broader European response as they prepare for the elections. And then we will have wrap-up with Antoine Rippold, director of the European Parliament Liaison Office with the U.S. Congress. Antoine is the most knowledgeable person about the European Parliament that I know, having served as an advisor to the European People's Party Group since 1999 and has served in a variety of distinctions as spokesman for the chairman, deputy secretary general. He really has the pulse, and he's the one I want to make some predictions at the end of this conversation. Now, we won't hold him to it, but we'd love to hear his thoughts. So welcome again. Sit back, relax. We're about to take a little cruise through European public opinion, and our cruise director is Bruce Stokes. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Heather. It's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here. And I'd like to thank CSIS for giving me the opportunity to share this data with you for this Pew survey. And I'd like to thank in advance my fellow panelists, both of whom I know and really appreciate their work. And they'll be able to add great context and perspective to some of this data, because the reality is this is a public opinion poll. It has great strengths, and public opinion polls also have great weaknesses. I mean, they are a snapshot. Moreover, we have not attempted to predict actually whether people are going to vote or not, and if they're going to vote, who they're going to vote for. I refer you to a number of national polls in each of the individual countries that are doing a very good job of trying to source out how many seats the Front National is going to get in France and how many seats UKIP are going to get in the UK. What we set out to do is to try to get a sense of what was the mood of the electorate as they headed towards the voting booths, because in part we think it would be useful after the election to try to understand why people voted the way they did and what will they expect once the election is completed, and also to give us a sense of various trends we've been following in Europe for the last number of years, because for the last couple of years in the wake of the euro crisis, we've been doing surveys in these seven European countries. And I can tell you, actually, in the past, it was very easy to write these reports because all the numbers went in the same direction, down. As Heather suggested, this is a much more nuanced finding. There are some things that might suggest some positive upswing, or at least things aren't getting worse, and then there are other things that might drive people in their decision on how to vote, which are extremely negative. And I'll leave it up to you to decide on a rainy day on Sunday when people have to decide whether they go to vote, whether being upset about something drives you to the polls more likely than feeling kind of wishy-washy positive about the EU and the economy. I can tell you, we know in American politics that, if you'll excuse my French, when people are pissed off, they're much more likely to vote than if they're just kind of feeling middle of the road. So, but we'll see. We have no idea how people are going to vote in the election. We have no idea how many people are going to show up. Do bear in mind, only 43% of the public showed up to vote 5 years ago. I think the consensus is that there'll be a slight uptick in turnout among various pollsters I've talked to in Europe. But I wouldn't expect it to be a profound uptick. We certainly don't ever tend to see those things in polls. And then the question, of course, is again, who votes? But what this survey will show us is whether the people voted or not, here is what they felt about the economy, about the EU, and about some of the other issues, such as migration, minorities, as they go to the polls. Just to give you briefly background, the Pew Research Center is one of the largest polling organizations in the United States. We're funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. We are nonpartisan, non-advocacy, non-commercial. Basically, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're just trying to give people an insight as to the outcome. We now survey abroad, and we've surveyed in 82 countries over the last 12 years, including surveys of 45 countries this year. And this survey is in 7 EU countries. I would point out that it was done in the last 2 weeks of March and the first week of April, so I would not overinterpret developments in Crimea or Ukraine as having influenced these results. Most of those happened after we were in the field. There may be a little bit of an impact there because the Maidan was already going on, but I wouldn't want to suggest that somehow this reflects post-Crimea, post-Russian meddling in Ukraine attitudes. Margin of error is about 4%, I would say. Telephone interviews in most countries, face-to-face in some others, standard operating procedure and methodology. Basically, what we found was that over the last couple of years, faith in the EU, and more importantly, I would argue, faith that economic integration is good for my country, which if you stop and think about it, that was the founding proposition of the common market in 1957, that if we can integrate our economies, we're all going to be better off. Well, in fact, last year, only about a quarter of Europeans actually believed that anymore. That's a pretty profoundly negative statement about the European Union. Those numbers have gone up a little bit. The attitudes towards the EU have gone up a little bit. I can tell you it's primarily because people feel a little bit better about the economy. When you do the regression analysis, you can see that it's basically all driven by economic attitudes, as were these numbers, right? I mean, as people thought things were getting worse, they were more likely to be negative about the EU. We did find that no matter how you framed it, people had negative sentiment about the EU and their interaction with it. They basically think it doesn't listen, it's out of touch, it's intrusive, and it's inefficient. Again, pretty powerfully negative sentiments. And since, especially on the right, there has been an agitation about migration and minorities, we ask people, do you want to increase migration, keep it the same, or decrease migration? As you can see, a median of over half want to decrease migration. But there is a wide variance here, which we'll get into later. And then attitudes towards minorities, it's Roma and Muslims that are actually bear the brunt of this anti-minority sentiment in almost every country.
Except Greece.
Greece is something we all need to talk about. 47% of Greeks have a negative attitude of Jews. I can't explain that. I was just talking actually to a Greek who works for us at Pew this morning about this. She had some views. These are anecdotal. We don't know, because we don't know from the survey why. I mean, I would caution you, it's one of the limitations of survey research. You don't know why people say what they say. You ask them a question, they give you an answer. And what you're picking up is emotion, not reason. And we, as people who are interested in policy, have to understand that most people operate on emotion. They vote on emotion. And we may think, gee, they don't have a good rational reason to feel this way. Well, that's kind of irrelevant, actually. It's us who have to get over that and realize that emotion does matter. And if 47% of the people say they have an unfavorable view of Jews, we have to kind of try to figure out what's going on here. And it's an emotion, probably, not rather than a reason. National economic conditions. The economy is a framer for a lot of this opinion. As I said, when we do our regression analysis, it really is pretty clear. It drives a lot of these attitudes. We ask people if they think the economic condition today is good or bad. It's actually, we ask them very good, somewhat bad, very bad. What you see is that 85% of the Germans think the economy is doing well. I must admit, my impression of that is that it's somewhat irrational exuberance. The economy is probably not doing that well, but very low unemployment, very low inflation, and the Germans just keep feeling better and better about the economy. But what's interesting, I think, and most significant about the survey across the seven countries, in most countries, you see that attitudes towards the economy basically have stopped falling. Now, some of these pickups are within the margin of error, so you can't suggest that they've necessarily improved. Although in the UK, look at this, they had dropped 54 percentage points in their perception of the economy through last year, since the beginning of the crisis. They've now regained about half of that. So things are looking up in the UK, you see then what impact that has. Notice that there are probably more Greeks who believe in space aliens than believe in their own economy, things are really quite bad there. We ask people, and this is one of the reasons I think that there's a certain amount of hope or optimism in this survey. We ask people every year, do you think the economy is going to get better over the next 12 months? It's not that people necessarily or overwhelmingly think it's going to get better, but basically the percentage of people who say it's going to get worse has actually gone down. Now, I admit, that's a backhanded way of being optimistic, but I don't think we should ignore it. The reality is 37% of Brits in 2013 said they thought the economy is going to get worse over the next 12 months. Now only 17% of Brits think that. This is one of the reasons people feel much better about everything. There's a sense that we see the light at the end of the tunnel, I think. There's a sense that maybe we're finally getting out of this euro crisis. That's particularly the case in Spain, for example. So I do think that is mildly positive sign, at least. How does this impact on views of the European project, which is really what we're talking about today? First off, we wanted to test in this survey, is there any idealism left about Europe in Europe after the 7 years of crisis? So we asked people, do you think the EU promotes peace? Bear in mind, this was the reason they founded the European Coal and Steel Community. It's the reason for the European Economic Community. It was, for God's sakes, we can never go to war again. We fought two world wars in half a century. I can tell you the discourse among elites in Europe is, oh, this is old hat. Nobody believes in this peace stuff anymore. It may well be that it's not a sufficient rationale for supporting the EU anymore. We don't know that. But what we do know from this survey is the public still believes that the EU promotes peace. It still credits the EU with this idealistic product. And in particular, I would underscore to you, the French and the Germans believe it. And at the end of the day, those are the two that really matter. It was the French and the Germans who went to war in World War I and World War II, and the whole purpose of creating the European Community was to make sure the French and the Germans didn't go to war again. And basically, the public seemed to say, yeah, the EU helped make that, helped us avoid that happening again. Another reason for the European Community and then the EU was to make Europe a better, bigger player on the world stage. People are less likely to agree with that. The Germans in particular aren't so sure the EU has delivered on that promise. And another purpose was to promote prosperity. It's not surprising that the Greeks and the Italians who are suffering actually think the EU no longer delivers on that, and we'll see some other data, I think, that confirms that. To my mind, the most significant question we ask every year is, do you think economic integration is good for your country? And what's interesting is that after it had declined in a number of countries, almost every country now, it's begun to bounce back. You know, it's still not great. Only 26% of the French think it's good for their country, but that's better than it was last year. What is significant, it seems to me, in this data is, look at Italy. It keeps going down. And I will tell you, if there's one conclusion from this survey, it is that Italy is the new problem child of Europe. I'll show you other sampling from Italy. It's not that things are worse in Italy than they are in Greece. Greece has hit the bottom. But Italians haven't hit the bottom yet in terms of public opinion, but they're headed in that direction. And it has policy implications. It's a much bigger economy. Let's be honest about that. Favorability of the EU, beginning to bounce back a little bit. Again, it's linked to people's perception either of the economy today or the future. It depends on the country you're surveying on. I must admit, I can't explain this in France. We just don't know. One French pollster said to me he thinks it's because the EU is just more in the news. And so people, it's in the news, I don't know much about it, but it must be positive because it's in the news. That's a fairly simplistic analysis. We don't know for sure. But there does seem to be a pickup in the favorability of the EU in France. Again, I can't explain it. What is, I think, terribly significant and hopeful here is that last year when we did this survey, what was striking is that attitudes towards the EU and towards economic integration among 18 to 29-year-olds had plummeted. And if you think about that as the next generation of Europeans, this was really not good for the European Union. Because people were losing faith. The people who were going to be running Europe and kind of voting in Europe for years and years were losing faith. There now seems to be a bounce back, especially in a number of these countries, and it may in fact explain some of what's happening in France, that younger people have, it's not that they necessarily overwhelmingly in some of these cases support the EU, and actually, they still aren't convinced that it's good for their economy, as they probably shouldn't, given the fact that in Spain or in Greece, youthful unemployment is still over 50%. But basically, it has stopped going down, and in some cases, it's going back up. We've asked people for the last 4 years, do you want us to keep the euro or go back to your older currency? What was always striking was that even in places like Greece or Spain, in the worst of times, no one wanted to go back to the lira or the drachma or wanted to go back to the peseta. It would have seemed that it was just a leap into the dark. Nobody wanted to take that risk. What's interesting is, and in fact, in Germany, last year it was 66% wanted to keep the euro. Now it's 72%. So the support for the euro has actually gone up in Germany. The interesting thing here is what's happening in Italy. The Italians are now basically divided on whether they want to keep the euro or go back to the lira. This is the first time in 4 years of asking this question that any country, there was less than 50% support for the euro. So again, Italy stands out and as a potential problem area. And I can tell you, when you look at inside our data, these are southern Italians who want to go back to the lira. Now, for those of you who know Italy, the Mezzogiorno has never been a great place. The economy of the Mezzogiorno has been horrible since time immemorial, right? But clearly, there's a bit of nostalgia going on here. where people basically, it's had to have been better than in the past than it was now. So, and I think the challenge that poses is, if we're right that it's nostalgia, it's non-rational. You know, if people around Milan said, we want to go back to the lira, you know, I work at Fiat, and if we could devalue our currency, we'd sell more cars. There'd be some logic to that, some rationality to that. Maybe it'd be bad for lots of other reasons, but there's a lot. I don't know if we can explain the logic of Southern Italians and why they want to go back to the lira, but I can tell you that's what's driving this. So it bears watching. What? Well, we know it's because there's no growth, but there was no growth in the Mezzogiorno before. So the question is it nostalgia? Is it, it had to have been better in the past, even though we know rationally it wasn't? And again, I would like to underscore this, we're talking about emotion here. I mean, people don't know why they want to go back to the lira or keep the euro. They just have a feeling about it. Yeah. Well, Italy was growing, yeah. Yeah, I don't know about the Mezzogiorno, though. I mean, that's a different, yeah, yeah. We ask in the EU, and we ask in the UK about staying in the EU. Last year, it was 46-46. People were divided down the middle as to whether they wanted to stay or leave. This year, it is 50% want to stay and 41% want to leave. I can tell you, I talked to YouGov when I was in the UK last week. They're finding the same thing. There's a slight uptick in the desire to stay in the EU. As you know, the referendum is still several years away, so this number could jump around. It is basically young people, well-educated people, and the wealthy who strongly support staying in the EU. Old people, conservatives want to leave. Basically, which is, again, I think what we might expect. We ask people what they thought about the various constituent institutions of the EU. As you can see, only about a third of the population has a positive view of the European Parliament, the European Commission, or the ECB. I think there's two takeaways here. One is that support for the European Parliament, as low as it is higher than the US support for the US Congress. So let's put this, yeah, so we have to put this in context, right? Then again, we're about to have an election for the European Parliament, and only a third of the public has a positive view of the European Parliament. A, it may affect turnout, and B, it may affect the results. The other takeaway, which I find very interesting, is that the polls love almost everything about the EU. The polls are clearly in the midst of a love affair with the EU, and this predates the worst stuff in the Ukraine. So I do think that that is interesting. And the fact that the polls basically don't belong to the ECB and they still like it. Now, as one wag said to me in Europe, if they were a member of the ECB, they may not like it, but we don't know that. We ask people about their personal interactions with the EU because, again, we don't know, but I think it's probably safe to assume that this may drive a lot of people to go vote because people who are upset tend to want to express that view. What's interesting is that overwhelmingly people's personal interactions with the EU are negative. They don't think the EU understands their needs. They think it's intrusive. They think it's inefficient. The polls are the only ones who actually marginally might say they think the EU is efficient. Now, they're one of the biggest recipients, if not the biggest recipient, of structural funds. Maybe if you get a lot of money from the EU, you feel good about it, it's about the efficiency of it. This is just to give you a visual sense of which populations feel the strongest about different emotions about the EU. Intrusive tends to be the one that most upsets people. And as a friend of mine at the EU Parliament told me on Tuesday, he said, if they think we're intrusive now, they just have to wait. If you think about what's happening in Europe, you know, with the banking legislation, with other things, for good or for ill, the EU is about to become even more intrusive, quote unquote, in people's lives. I think the other issue to bears thinking about, which we don't know the answer to, and we won't know the answer to, is even if the economy picks up, are these attitudes going to change? Because some of these may be just knee-jerk emotions about, yeah, you got to be upset about something, so you're, oh, they're intrusive and they're, I mean, you think about some of the attitudes Americans have about government. You know, they could be huge beneficiaries of government and they still don't like it. You know, I mean, so these are, again, these are emotions. These are not reason. And so these emotions may transcend the current situation and thus complicate matters. People don't think the EU listens, basically. What I find ironic about this, and again, we don't know, 71% of the Germans say the EU doesn't listen. I will bet you any money if we'd ask other people in Europe, who does the EU listen to most? They would have said the Germans. So, but you know, basically people don't think they're listened to. But bear in mind, many of them don't think their own government listens to them. The European Barometer also asked this question, found more or less the same thing. People are more likely to say that their own government listens to them than Brussels listens to them, which frankly, if that weren't the case, we'd really have trouble. You know, what is interesting is, look at this, the Italians don't think Rome listens and they don't think Brussels listens. They don't think anybody listens. They're just upset. And I also think it's interesting that the French are the most likely to think Paris listens and they're most likely to think Brussels listens. Now, whether that's in fact because they do listen or it's a reflection on kind of the French egotism, I don't know, but we'll see over time. But I mean, look at that. I mean, basically, the French are much more likely than others to say people listen to us. The upshot of all of this, mostly negative sentiment, is that very few people even want to consider giving more power to Europe over economic issues. So the whole debate about more Europe has very little support in Europe at this point among the public. The polls are kind of divided on the issue. The Germans are actually kind of divided on the issue. But for the most part, people are against it. Doesn't mean it won't happen. Doesn't necessarily have to happen. But it's a sell to people, it hasn't been made yet, that's for sure. Finally, especially on the right, there's been a lot of talk about migration and about minorities and a number of analysts think this is going to drive a lot of the turnout in the election. Basically, we ask people about migration, and we ask people what they thought about immigrants. I mean, do they think immigrants take our jobs and benefits, or do they think immigrants' talents help our economy? What's interesting is in places like Greece or Italy, overwhelmingly people say they take our jobs and benefits. And by the way, we'd like to limit immigration. What I think is notable here is that Germany, only 29% of the public thinks that immigrants take our jobs and benefits. 66% of people in Germany say that we benefit from the talents of immigrants. So why is it that only 14% of the German public wants to increase immigration? There's a real kind of contrast there, it seems to me. It's very interesting. Now, the Germans are among the least likely to want to limit immigration, but for the most, like 40% just want to keep it the same. Only 14% want to increase immigration. And that may be because the Germans are fairly worried about crime from immigration, second only to the Greeks, and they're fairly worried about assimilation, that immigrants don't assimilate. Only the Italians are more likely to say that immigrants don't assimilate. We ask about particular minority groups, the Italians in particular and the Greeks and the Poles have pretty negative views of Muslims. Notice that the two populations that have the largest Muslim population are the ones with the least negative sentiment towards Muslims. Now, it's still a quarter of the population, bear in mind, so it's not as if there's this love affair with Muslims, but it is lower than a lot of these other countries. And not surprisingly, it's people on the right who are most critical of Muslims, by far. We ask about Roma. Bear in mind, there are very few Roma in Europe. but the Italians in particular have a negative view. The French have a very negative view. The Spanish actually have a positive view, which is, some of you may understand Spain better than I do, might have some explanation for that. And we ask about attitudes towards Jews. What is interesting here is this. 47% of Greeks have a negative view of Jews. Again, I would welcome people's attempt to help to try to understand that. 26% of Poles have a negative view of Jews, given the anti-Semitic history in Poland. That's a fairly significant number. Only 5% of Germans have a negative view. I can tell you it was about 21%, I think, or 26% actually in 1991. So it's actually gone down in Germany. I will admit to you some of these questions about minorities. There are issues about whether we're picking up political correctness. You know, do people feel uneasy telling you what they really feel because they know it's politically incorrect? That's been one of the criticisms I got when I was in Europe on this. The only thing I can say is it would appear to be politically correct in some countries to express this feeling, but not politically correct in others, so we have to explain that discrepancy. And also, it is if it's politically incorrect in Germany, say, to voice criticism of Jews, why was it politically correct in 1991 to voice that criticism but not today? So, I mean, I think that political correctness doesn't necessarily explain these views. I think we just need to take them at face value and try to figure out what impact that may have on the politics going forward. All of this stuff is on the Pew website. It's free. It's, more importantly, it's searchable. So if any of you have a question about, gee, has Pew ever asked a question about attitudes towards climate change in Europe? Yeah, we have, and the questions are there. So it's, anyway, I highly recommend it to you. And thank you for listening.
Bruce, thank you. That was terrific and lots of good meat in there, which I'm looking forward to diving into during the question and answer period. Okay, well, let's turn to Olaf to give us the perspective from Berlin, from the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks, Olaf.
Thank you, Heather, for the invitation. Thanks to CSS, thanks to Pia and the Ebel Foundation to having me here. It's a great pleasure coming from Germany, so where the news are split. So half of it, it's about the European elections, and the other half, it's about Russia and what's going on our eastern border. So therefore, let me allow to, as you already announced, actually to take you a step back and try to give you the broader picture. So in which context the debate in Europe is taking place these days, and especially in Germany. So, but let me start with a more historical, but very personal historical aspect. So, as somebody who was born in the 70s, so I would call myself a kid of the 80s, and especially in 86, Europe was one of the biggest things ever. So, Most Favorable was a group of blonde Swedish rock musicians, actually, and their top hit was The Final Countdown. So I think it's an interesting analogy. So to these days, so are we looking on The Final Countdown for Europe, looking at the elections, talking about Europe in 2014? I think it's a continent in crisis, but it's not just what has been expressed, as you said, Bruce, on an internal crisis. Of course, we all know this started with the banking crisis, with this economic crisis, so which was always called the Euro crisis, which I think is the wrong leading expression. So it was a banking crisis, it was a government debt crisis, also growth and competitiveness crisis. And these days, it's quite interesting to see we're also challenged by an external crisis, as I already mentioned, so by President Putin, Russia, what's happening in the Ukraine, on our eastern border. And I remember back in February, talking to our senior diplomat in Germany. That was just the day when the German foreign minister traveled to Kiev together with his French and Polish colleague to negotiate with Yanukovych, and he said, "So if this goes wrong, we are really in deep trouble." So because it's not just the geostrategic implications, but then we are talking about refugees on our eastern border. We are talking about closing down the Polish border. Things in a similar context, we already were familiar with having the Arab Spring just on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea, but there was a border, a natural border in between, and all of a sudden this became very real. I think a continent in crisis, of course, this has three aspects. We're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the big round of enlargement in the European Union these days. And if journalists are asking me, so what are the benefits of enlargement countries these days or back in the day, so I always used to say, okay, it's about security, it's about stability, and it's about prosperity. And in a way, I think this is the European promise to its own people. So this is what the criteria is people are measuring if it's desirable to live in the European Union. And as we already listened to, of course, the prosperity issue, so the single market, the common currency was the big thing in recent days. The security issue now with the peace project, and it's true what Bruce said from a German perspective, so this is the ongoing debate in Berlin, so people are fed up about the peace narrative, so the peace project, actually young people don't believe in it any longer, and now having a Russian president challenging this project as such, so you can have lively debates with young people on the streets and there's nobody doubting that this is what the European Union is about. It's about freedom, it's about the rule of law, democracy, it's about human rights. So this is the European success model. But at the same time, they use these standards actually and translate them to the internal dimension. And as you said, so prosperity, of course, is the one thing, but it's also about legitimacy and it's about efficiency. So these are the criteria out in the public debate. And so if we then take this broader perspective back to the question, so what does this mean for the European elections? I think you can identify there are more or less three broader political camps. The one is the camp which calls for less Europe. These are the Eurosceptics. These are people who want to renationalize, actually, a lot of things which they connect to Europe. Then there's the camp actually, so which just wants to prevail the status quo. So, and I think this is the majority of political parties and governments in Europe these days. But interesting enough, this is actually the camp which belonged to the third one, which called for further steps of integration for decades. So the more Europe expression became completely hollow these days because but nevertheless, you can listen to it on every panel when politicians discussing and running for the European Parliament. So it's about more Europe. So, but as soon as you ask, okay, how do you define this? So what is more Europe in your eyes? It becomes really muddy. So what might happen, of course, is that we end up with a significant chunk of Eurosceptic parties. So which as such are an interesting group because you can also divide them into various camps. You have the very far right, you have the just a little bit right or a little bit far right in between. You have the very critical European critic conservatives, and then you have another camp on the left, so like with Syriza in Greece and others. So what's uniting them is this attitude, okay, it's about less Europe. Although they are addressing a lot of interesting issues, and this is the challenge for the established parties these days. So how to regain trust of your citizens? I think it's about honesty. It's about take your citizens seriously. And as it came out in the survey, listen to your citizens. So it's not done by just repeating this. This credo of, okay, it's about more Europe, it's about more integration. So people are interested in, okay, how do you define this? And I think this is the big challenge for the day after the final countdown, so May 26. It comes with a lot of interesting challenges. It's also about restructuring the institutional framework and the setup in Brussels. And one of the big questions, of course, is, okay, and this is this was a joke I used to make moderating panels like this with people, colleagues from think tanks and politicians saying, okay, who of you really believes that the next president of the EU Commission is called Martin Schulz or Jean-Claude Juncker? So, and to be honest, none of them did. so in this group, which was quite frightening. And then you ask, okay, why that? So we're talking about a deficit in legitimacy. So and then you get the answer, okay, but it's not a presidential system, so people are not voting directly for the president of the commission. And then, of course, the European Union is a tricky beast, so which means you have the council, so which has a huge say in this. We don't know how the parliament, which has also now, after the Lisbon Treaty, a huge say in accepting the nomination by the council, acts. And in the end, it's not always the easiest solution to take the politician who just gained the most votes. So sometimes it might be a third candidate. But of course, it will be a huge challenge for this issue of regaining trust by European citizens if none of them actually will be at least in a reliable, really transparent way, actually end up in the closing group of candidates. And then thirdly, I think the third challenge after regaining trust of citizens and restructuring the institution setup is positioning Europe on the global agenda. So this is with this external crisis and the challenge actually of the Western European model we're standing for. So this is obviously something Europeans are rethinking, and it's not any longer up to my friends on this side of the Atlantic actually to call up on the Europeans, okay, you have to step up and take responsibilities. Just the day before yesterday, I attended the big conference in the German foreign ministry set up by the foreign minister in the aftermath of the Munich Security Conference, setting up a process which is called the Review 2014 process to have a picture, okay, what's Germany's role in a European context in international affairs? So, and it was a lively debate. It goes now to a public, very interesting phase where the foreign ministry tries to engage with the German public opinion of, okay, so do you think we have to take more responsibilities on this side? But I think the answer cannot be a national answer, actually. It has to be a European answer. So what's Germany's role in Europe? And so therefore, looking forward also in this context to what's the results of May 25th. If I may add, so if you're interested in more, the ECFR just published a policy brief on the issue of the Eurosceptics. It's called the Eurosceptic Surge and how to respond to it. And I had the privilege to participate in a very interesting project, unfortunately only interesting for those who read German. It's called the Europe Atlas, published by the Böll Foundation in cooperation with the ECFR, which has a number of very interesting graphs and statistics, actually, to make it more visible. And the funny thing is that we were not really sure about the reception of it, and it's already sold out, and we are thinking of publishing it also in English edition, so you can see it everywhere on the public transport, people reading this stuff. So there is an interest, actually, to learn more about also the positive things of Europe, and I think that's a very good precondition, actually, to enter the next phase. Thank you very much.
Olaf, thank you so much. Antoine, I think you're going to have to answer Olaf's question of why Martin Schulz and Mr. Juncker may not become candidates. I'm so provocative. Go.
Thank you also to organizing this event, and so to Pierre and colleagues. I will begin with what can we expect from these elections. So I don't read in the future, but we can imagine what's going to happen, and also with what Bruce told me. First, the level of participation. We expect that it will be rather more what it was last time. So we don't expect big changes, which is on EU, for EU standards, not so great, but for midterm US standards, as you said, quite good. Actually, the double of what we expect in November. So, okay, you have to put everything in perspective. Difference is that in Europe, it's a big issue. In America, nobody talks about that, I think. So, but anyway, but this time, it's not so much the question. In the previous election, the big issue was the level of participation. This time it is an element because it shows interest or not of citizens, but this time what is really interesting is two things, is what will be the ratio between extremists or non-mainstream, let's say, because it's hard to say. I mean, there are the Euroskeptics and those on the extreme left and right, so I would rather talk of the non-mainstream. Probably what we expect is the non-mainstream will double their score, which is quite a lot. At the moment, we have more or less 13%. We expect we will have around 25%. So it is a lot, and obviously, politically, it's an important factor. If in France, in my country, you have the Front National first, it's politically significant. If in Britain, UKIP is first or second, it's politically significant, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a political element that will be, I guess, the big comment of the day. That said, if you have, I'm not very good at mathematics, but if you have 25% against, let's say, the actual EU construction, that means you have 75 in favor. Some people say, well, yeah, but it's true, but actually if you count the people who vote and people who don't vote, it's less than, well, okay, but in a democracy you count with those who vote. And so the reality of this parliament will be, of course, that the extremes or the non-mainstream parties or political groups will be on the fringes, but that the mainstream groups will be pro-European. And they'll have different ideas, the socialists and the EPP and the liberals and the Greens do not, as you obviously, share all ideas, and they have their divides and they have their... But what really makes, at this particular moment of the European Parliament and construction of the EU, what makes this Parliament very strange, I mean, for it's a strange animal for a normal person, it is that, I mean, normally in any Parliament, the divide is between left and right, right? Well, in the Parliament, it is that, but mostly it is about, are you in favor of a stronger EU integration or not? And that has been a key factor in the last 5 years with the, I agree, it's not good to say the euro crisis, but the financial crisis. You had the pro-European, those who wanted the banking union, those who wanted the six-pack, the two-pack, I mean, all those who wanted more governance of the euro, and those who didn't want it. And all the main parties, the four main parties, the center-right, the social democrats, the liberals, and the Greens, spend their time voting together. Not absolutely, not perfectly, but roughly this is how this parliament in this ending mandate managed to have 500 laws adopted. It's quite a lot. And of course, not all these laws are equivalent in terms of quality and importance, but still, governance of the Euro, banking union, there was an agreement between. And what's going to happen if we have, if we have a doubling of the non-mainstream party, that means that the parties in the middle will tend to be more cohesive because of that. So that's what we can expect from these elections. But we'll see on Sunday. Many of you will be away, Virginia Beach or somewhere. But those who are not, we organize an event on Sunday to watch the results live. How will this parliament behave for the European integration? I just said it. I mean, what the parliament probably will, and you said that before. I mean, if people believe the parliament is intrusive, well, they have to see what's going to happen. It is going to become more and more intrusive, and this is not only the fact of the European Parliament. Many people do not, well, forget. That's because their national politicians don't tell them that a law in Europe is not only made by the European Parliament, but it's also made by the member states. So if there is no majority in the member states, and if there is no majority at the parliament, there's no law. That's as simple as that. So the member states and the European Parliament probably in the next years are going to make more laws and have more European integration. So that is probably what's going to happen. How will the parliament will, and that's a more risky thing, behave towards America? So I have to be careful here. So at the moment, the mainstream of the parliament, and again, it's now 80% of this parliament, is in favor of TTIP, is in favor of, is globally rather pro-US, if it means anything. So we tend to believe that the US our natural partner, and we want to do more with the US, because it makes sense economically, because it makes sense politically, because we consider that the US our great brother. Well, not on, well, now we great brother in two significations. But anyway, we believe, you know, we feel brothers or cousins or family. Anyway, well, with this parliament, it could be a bit more tricky because already you see that TTIP is very much in the conversations. When we have the debate last week between the candidates for president of the commission, TTIP was not so much talked about, but the most numbers of tweets and conversation online were about TTIP, and I can tell you it was not so positive. So we have to worry maybe about that. And if our citizens worry about TTIP, well, of course our MEPs will worry about TTIP because it's their constituents. So we have to maybe to worry about that. Privacy will be an issue where the parliament will continue to be extremely active and maybe not so easy with the US. So that's an issue. And surveillance, I mean, the two are linked, are different, but are linked. So it will be, I always tell my friends here at State Department, you should consider the European Parliament is a bit like your Congress. Which is that we are annoying. We are, you know, we are not like a national parliament. It's quite, in a national parliament, it's quite simple because you have a majority and you have an opposition. And if a government has the majority, well, you don't have much to worry about it. The parliament is different because we don't have a majority, we don't have an opposition, we have various majorities and various oppositions. And depending on the topic, it changes. So it is a very difficult body to control. I would just end with this question of Juncker or Schulz or Verhofstadt or Keller. It can look very, you know, very bureaucratic and very technocratic, the story of the presidential candidate. But actually, when I say we, it's mostly the European parties and the parliament, but mostly the European parties, the socialists, the center-right, the Greens, the liberals. Who say, you just said that people distrust the EU or believe that we are too intrusive. The reality is that so far we don't really manage to have a debate on policies. And this is why the populists are gaining, everybody talks about populists, about extremes, but nobody really talked during the campaign that now ended yesterday about real issues, which is, do we need or not a European strategy on energy, for example? Do we have a European policy? Do we need European policy? And if it is, what kind of energy mix do we need? That's a real European discussion. Did we have it? Not really. And the Ukrainian elections will take place the same day, Sunday. Do we have a discussion about immigration? We don't have a discussion about immigration. The member states always refuse to put that together to share sovereignty on this policy. At the same time, they complain when they are, and rightly I understand that, for example, southern Italians are worried to see these poor people, arriving in Lampedusa. So they are really unhappy when they have to deal with this situation. At the same time, they are the first to say, no, this is national sovereignty, so we have to know what we want there. So my point is to say that what really we need is Europe is to decide what we want. Do we want to share our strategy and policy on the big issues, not on everything, but probably on the economy, on energy, on immigration? So there are big issues where we should decide together. It's not a question of loving Europe or hating Europe. It's a question of where are we more efficient in deciding certain things. So I think talked about emotion, there's not enough emotion. It's true. Brussels tend to be technocratic. At the same time, there is too much emotion in the sense that we believe that you love or you hate Europe. Do you speak about hating or loving the US? Well, you do, but not really. I mean, the talk should be about policy. What do we do? I mean, how do we decide and are we more efficient? How do we drive more growth and jobs? This is the question for people. The economy is stupid. It's always the same topic for elections. And the big topic should have been during these elections, are we more efficient to fight unemployment and growth if we are separated, if we are one by one, I mean Germany or Britain, et cetera, or are we more efficient if we talk about strategy and if we decide on a strategy? So I finish that by that. Why do we have this race between the candidates? Because we want people to understand that what we do in Brussels is legitimate. It's not something that is imposed by I don't know whom. It's something that should be discussed, debated, and to in order to do that, you need to have a person that is in the incarnation of this policy. So, of course, the President of the Commission is not a Chancellor of Germany, but it has a power in Europe. So it's a beginning, it's the first step. So we want people to understand that exactly like in Germany, when you vote for CDU, it means you are for Mrs. Merkel, and when you vote for SPD, you are for her opponent. If you vote for your MEP who is from the socialist group, then it means that you will have Mrs. Schulz. So the point of the mainstream groups of the parliament, I stop there, is that if after the elections on Sunday, the socialist or the EPP or the liberal, whatever group political family wins, even by a small margin, the one which arrives first should have the responsibility to form a majority of the parliament. And the candidate, Mr. Schulz, is not the moderator of the socialist campaign. He is the candidate for president of the commission. That should be taken seriously. And I can bet you that if after the elections, if there's a clear winner, even by a few seats, if the European Council says, well, you know, I don't really like Mr. X or Mrs. Y, and I would much prefer to have this one because it would be more manageable for me, I can bet you, well, I have to take risks sometimes, but I don't take many risks. I can bet you that the Parliament will say no in July. So it's not that we are going to say no. That's very simple. Anyway, when I say we, I don't vote, but my members. Anyway, thank you very much.
Anton, thank you. Olaf, and again, Bruce, thank you so much. Great discussion. I think, you know, as I've been asked as well, you know, what are the headlines Monday morning when we wake up? I think the headline is, you know, this does matter to the United States. The future composition of the European Parliament will have very important implications for trade, for data sharing between our countries, for future prosperity and security transatlantically. This does matter. This is important. Obviously, attention is also going to be paid to the Ukrainian elections, but this is important. Let's keep our eye on the ball. I think the headline is going to be the doubling of the non-mainstream parties, and that has been the headlines for many, and I think we have to take that very seriously. And what concerns me is that we do imagine where the mainstream parties, particularly Social Democrats, EPP, and then the others, will form a grand coalition to block those voices out. And so are we listening? Are these institutions responsible? I sort of see this dynamic, and I understand it, across many European countries, Germany itself, where you have these grand coalitions, and you feel like you have no choice when you vote, because it's the mainstream parties, and in some ways blocking that. So I think that's a dynamic that we have to, I'd welcome your thoughts on that. I have to say, I think the headline is going to be the following week, and watching how different member states digest this election. Now, it's not a national election, but it has huge national implications. And the place I'm focusing on is Greece, because at the same time Greece is holding municipal elections, they've had the first vote last week. If you have a massive vote for Syriza, that is a two-vote majority in the Greek Parliament. I'm very worried about Italy. Bruce, I mean, you laid it out. This is a country in distress, and we know the politics are very volatile. That actually the story here is how this shakes the very fragile coalitions, and that actually will have implications about how member states. So I'd welcome reflections on the implications of particular member states and how we take a look at that. What I'd love to do, you can sort of think through what you want to answer in that or any comments you'd want to offer on each other's presentations. We have about 25 minutes for good conversation. If you can raise your hand, we'll have microphones. If you can give us your name, your affiliation. What we love here at CSIS is you keep your comments short, but your questions very provocative. So what I'm going to do is bundle, and then you guys can fire away at it. So I'm going to start right up here in the front, James, and we're going to sort of go tick-tock-toe, and we'll go right across an angle and get their questions. Thank you.
Hi, thanks. I was particularly interested in the...
could you identify yourself?
I'm Charles Wessner with Georgetown University. The... you know, it was tremendous information. I would, and I compliment you on it. I want to stress that. At the same time, I'd like to make some observations, not criticisms, that you might want to juxtapose some things. Take the OECD figures. and put the different paths of economic growth and expectations, and then put that against how you feel about the EU. I mean, I think you've got derivatives here. They're dependent variables. I'd love to see for the minorities, for example, you could posit some, you know, the Poles don't like Jews. They just forget that there are only 6,000 of them left, so it's really hard to blame them for much. But they don't hesitate, which I, so there's some historical things there. You might want to talk about the democracy and trust. Europeans tell me there's a democracy deficit. You know, they love democracy unless the elections go badly, and then they stop the process because otherwise you might not get the right answer. Mr. Putin has an understanding of that. He could advise them, I suppose. Peace. They favor peace. And is it the EU? NATO's there too, isn't it? You know, I was very pleased. I hope that the EU is now massing its divisions on the German, Ukrainian, Polish borders. I mean, you're moving troops now from the EU, I would think, and moving people up to the Baltics. Isn't that who's doing it? So, no, there's a moment of almost absurdity that approaches. I think the Americans had something to do with peace in Europe, helped by stark fear of the Soviet Union. So the I really submit that the question being asked there is a little bit curious. Economic integration and growth, right on. Peace in Europe, I think there are perhaps other sources. And the and in that same vein, you might ask, do we get security, stability, and prosperity? Probably prosperity. Security has just been knocked out from under. So I'll stop there. But again, my compliments on very, as a last resort, actually ask people. But on the other hand, putting up data next to that, I think would considerably enhance the value of the report. The and I have one last question for Olaf, just a short question. The Economist had a wonderful cover about who will America defend the other day, about 2 weeks ago. Who will the Germans fight for?
The fight for?
Mm-hmm. I said fight.
Question. I'll just keep passing that microphone right across.
Mike Macedic, PBS Online News Hour on European Affairs. In the debate last week, which the European Institute very kindly provided a feed for so that a few of us wonks could actually go over and listen to these folks, who three of the five spoke English, which was very accommodating of them. The Green Party, you said they're in the mainstream in the European Parliament, but the Green Party candidate specifically took her party out of the TPP. I know we're a long way from even having a treaty much, and by the way, what is the, in this US Senate, you need a 2/3 vote to ratify a treaty. What is, or is it 3/4? I can't even remember. What's the margin you have to in the European Parliament? Because if you get 25% non-mainstream, the Greens vote against this. There are a lot of socialists under pressure because of the investment stuff to vote against this thing. I'm somewhat less sanguine than you are about the fact this treaty is going through. And another question for Bruce, more as a guy who has politics in his bones rather than as a pollster. If you were the head of the French Socialist Party, wouldn't you be rather worried that 2 days before a major election with the National Front breathing down your neck, that the major news story in France is that the government train corporation has spent $15 billion buying a bunch of trains that aren't going to fit in the stations?
Hi, I'm Dr. Donna Wells. I'm an expert in the Russian language internet. Do we think it's a realistic scenario that in the next few decades, major European powers will exit the EU? Thank you.
Stanley Kober. I'm looking at an interview with an official of the Hellenic Bank Association in Greece. According to the latest data from the Bank of Greece, he reports, non-performing loans account for roughly 31% of total loans in Greece. Generally speaking, he concludes, the situation is alarming. How do you get out of 31% non-performing loans once the tapering takes hold here?
And that's why public opinion is not so great in Greece. Yes.
Thank you. Orion Donovan-Smith with Blue Star Strategies. We've seen recently some of the far-right parties, Front National in France, Ataka in Bulgaria, and some others, increasingly move close to Russia, even meeting and very openly with the Russian government. Could some of you address what effect these the upcoming elections might have on the ability of the parliament or Europe, the EU as a whole, to come to a consensus and act vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine?
And that's great. I'll just two-finger that. And I think that's one of the other headlines, where the doubling of the mainstream parties that are anti-EU, anti-US, and will be very supportive of Mr. Putin. How does that reflect in headline news? I think we have one more. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Kelly Rincon with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. I had a question about just these nationalist parties in general. I know there's a lot of theories about why they're gaining traction and why people are voting for them, whether it's protest votes against domestic governments or anti-immigration, anti-EU. And I was just curious for your perspective on why you think is the core reason that a lot of these countries are now supporting these movements more so than in the past, and why it's happening in some countries and not in other EU countries.
That's a seminar unto itself. So Bruce, I'm gonna have you attack whatever you want to attack, and we'll just go right down the line.
Well, I think you raised an interesting point in that last question, that it's generally the far right that is more critical of the EU, but it's not exclusive. I mean, it's the far left in Spain and Greece, in our survey at least, who are more critical of the EU. And I think it has to do with the internal narrative. I mean, in Greece and Spain, the left blames the EU for the imposition of austerity, which obviously they think has been too hard on people they care about and people who vote for them. Whereas what may be driving the far right sentiment in other countries is other sentiments. So I do think that while the anecdotal evidence in the press coverage is mostly about the far right, there actually is a far left. I mean, if you in France, the far left is also very critical of the EU. The Linke in Germany is also very critical of the EU. They just happen to be smaller parties, so they don't get as much attention. Great question on TTIP and how that fares in the European Parliament, it seems to me. It's way too early, I think, to judge. Antoine might have a good sense of that, but I think that we have to get there first. We have to get a deal. But I can tell you, since Pew did a survey about TTIP in Germany and compared it then to attitudes towards TTIP in the United States, there's far more doubt about TTIP in Germany than we originally thought when we originally decided to do the survey with the kind support of the Bertelsmann Foundation. And I would say that we thought at the time maybe the survey story was going to be, oh, the Germans like this and the Americans have questions. In fact, what we found was, and on some of these aspects, the Germans were even more questioning than the Americans, suggested the kind of trouble this might be in. And I can tell you, having just spent 10 days in Europe, it comes up everywhere, and the criticisms are the same. So there's a lot of a challenge here. I think that question on far right and its attraction to Russia came up in almost every country I was in while I was in Europe, and it is fascinating. That New York Times piece that appeared a couple of days ago, I mean, the reporter was doing what reporters should do. They write about what they're hearing about, and I'll tell you, I was hearing about it too. And, it seems to be that Putin's a strong leader, and Europe blocks strong leaders, and Putin's standing up for traditional values, and we don't have traditional values anymore, and at least in the perception of some people in Europe. But the broader issue that I think Olaf would be better to address is the question about what is it that Europe would fight for? And I think that's that profound question of the sentiment, especially in Germany, because we've seen some of the polling data in Germany, not ours, other people's, that the Germans would like to be in the middle, they'd like to be the arbiter between, and, you know, whether that's the American perspective of where the Germans should be, I'm not, we don't know what the American public would think, but I don't think it's the American establishment's view of where Germany should be. But it was very profound when I was there. That the as one very senior British official said to me, his sentiment about the Germans were that they felt like Ukraine was not worth the job of a single Pomeranian engineer. And if I'm not saying that's what the average German thinks, but if it is the perception, we may have problems down the road. And I think that that's, in terms of transatlantic relations, this is one of the things that really should be followed closely. And I think Heather's point is the very interesting day after question, is to what extent and in what ways do the national governments begin to chase these disgruntled voters after the election? You know, it's going to be a wake-up call. They know it's there, but now they're going to have to confront it. UKIP will do really well. Front National will do really well. AfD in Germany will probably do better than people would like, at least the establishment would like. And then how does the national leadership, and what issues do they choose to kind of try to lean in that direction to kind of go after it? Because that has then policy complications and implications that we can't predict, but I think just all of us who follow politics know that's what happens when you get a wake-up call from the voter, the establishment policies parties try to chase those voters. And watch this screen, because I think it's going to be a very interesting and potentially confusing message is going to come out.
Ah, please.
Yeah, thank you. Also on the Europe critics, so the last question. So what one sentiment, actually, so because you pointed out rightly to the leftist criticism, actually. So, and going back to my Europe Swedish band in the 80s, actually. So what you can see is a revival of the anti-globalization narrative. So yeah. With this, so which is really striking. So and the TTIP thing comes also into this. Yeah. So there's this. A lot of the criticism, of course, goes into, and you can find this, especially in Greece and other countries, in Spain, so it's all about capitalism. So we rescued big banks, so what are you doing for the people, actually? So you're just looking for your interest rates, that's it, actually, so but you don't give a damn, actually, so what's the situation on the ground? So, and what's happening in general, as I try to describe, is that you really, so you have a shift of the parties actually to the right, so I would call it in a way actually it's some kind of a Tea Party effect actually. So you see that conservative parties who used to praise the advantages of integration for the good of the people actually are becoming more and more critical, at least in rhetoric. So it's another thing what they're really doing. So because that's the fascinating story about Angela Merkel. So on the one hand, so the SPD tried to run the national election campaign last year on the narrative that, okay, whatever the government said they are not doing, the next day they did it. So they said there will be no sand for Greece, actually, so that was the first rescue package. Then they said, okay, there will be a temporary umbrella, actually, to save the market, so, but will not be fixed. No, that there will be no umbrella, actually. Then there was the other day, actually, the umbrella. Then they said it will not be a permanent one. Then they came up with the ESB, the SAF, things like that. So, but the thing is, people did not care about it. So what was interesting, and this is really interesting, this disconnect of the Germans from the rest of Europe, is that we are living, as you said, so in this big Switzerland phenomenon. So as long as we live a decent life, things are okay. So this is what I tried for the last 2 years to make people understand. So the Germans have no desire to tell others how to live. So there was never ever, because that we had this discussion, this criticism of, okay, we don't want to live in a German Europe, so things like that. And the funny thing is these days that it's happening, damn if you do, if damn if you don't. So first, everybody called for German engagement to rescue the euro, to save Europe. So once the Germans did, then everybody said, no, but we don't want to live under German dictatorship, things like that. So, and it's the same now with foreign policy. And another senior diplomat the other day said, okay, German leadership is in international affairs, in a European context, is best executed if nobody realized that's German leadership behind it. So, and this is what we tried for years, actually. So, and I always try to say, so you, the German attitude, and this goes to the question, so what are we fighting for? The German sentiment is, okay, we screwed it up in World War II, definitely, of course, so. Then we have been told by our best allies for 50 years, don't get your hands off serious politics, so don't get engaged, actually. You can pay for it in the end, but that's it. Don't engage in this. So, and thirdly, of course, so people are very critical of the use of violence. So the interesting thing is if you look into the German polls these days, so you can see in the beginning, everybody thought, okay, the Ukraine crisis can be, so people can moderate the crisis of the agenda, actually. So we don't have to engage. So it's just about, okay, we have to wait. So don't try to escalate the situation. So therefore, calls from the US saying, okay, now we need a quick enlargement of NATO. Ukraine, Georgia have to come on the fast track, actually. So people oppose this completely. So, but these days, you can see that polls from last week actually prove that Germans realize, okay, it will not be that easy. So it's not done by just sending Wolfgang Ischinger to Kiev, actually, and moderate a round table. So, and it was the first time that there was a majority within Germany saying, okay, and if really the worst case scenario happens, so then Germany has to engage military to fight for European interests. So that was surprising to me. So, and I think the entire process, so what the federal president in his speech said in Munich, so we have to stop hiding ourselves behind these we are not allowed to engage arguments. So this is over. So, but the thing is, the translation in German minds is not okay. Now, actually, so we have the same tradition like the French and the Brits and the US actually just pumping up our defense budgets and let's send German troops up, off to the world. That's not the thing. So therefore, the challenge for this process I described in the end, so that the foreign minister started now to reinvent German foreign policy, will be, so what can be the German contribution to this? So how can we support the civil aspects of diplomacy? So this is not, it's not by chance that Frank-Walter Steinmeier, I think, is the most traveling foreign minister in Europe these days. So you can see him actually everywhere. So it's a little bit like with Kerry in the Middle East process. So he was all over the place. And it was interesting because I talked to the guys from the German MFA. So because then you can come up with a democracy deficit and say, okay, but then it's back to the member states, so where's the European component, so. But he told me, okay, the day when the three ministers traveled to Yanukovych, so they had an agreement, they called Katie Ashton, who, she was involved in the E3 plus 3 or P5 plus 1 negotiations in Geneva with Iran, couldn't be in Kiev. They agreed on a setup, the European External Action Service synchronized this with all the member states, and then the message went back from the action service to the guys in Kiev saying, okay, Europe is fine with this, you can do it. So therefore, there's a lot of things going up behind which are not so transparent, not so public, so, but you can see, so Europe is stepping up to this. Maybe I'll leave it with that.
Give you the last word, and then I'll welcome Pia for closing remarks.
So four remarks. The first one, I can assure you that the Greens were in the last years, not the same, Greens were in the last 4 years very much working closely on many issues with the EPP, with the Socialists, and with the Liberals, mm-hmm. especially on the governance of the euro, that's for sure. The second thing is, do we respect the extremes or the anti-Europeans if we don't do what they want? Well, we live in a democracy. I mean, if in a democracy, in a parliament, you have 25% of people who don't think mainstream and you have a mainstream of 75%, what should the parliament do? well, do what mainstream want. I mean, that's democracy, that's fine. It's maybe the simple reasoning, but I think we have not done better than that in democracy so far. Accession, the TTIP, so two things. One, I think we will, I mean, to make it happen, we need a strong political leadership on both sides. Do we have this strong leadership? I will not say. It's up to you to decide, but I think we really need that because if the challenges, at least that were announced, are really high. If you have big challenges, if it's a big discussion, negotiation, it means that everybody will have to make a compromise. If you have to make compromise, you have to have the political leaders to make sure that their populations buy it. So that's my first point. The second is the question of privacy, the question of surveillance will not go away. This is, of course, in Germany, it's more acute than in other countries, but I can assure you it is something, and often my friends here have the feeling that it will go away. It will not go away. We may take long holidays in summer, but we remembered in September, after the Snowden issue in September, we remembered that it happened, and we continue. And the Parliament has voted two months ago, resolution that is very strong. So we are not going to forget that. And at the moment that the members of Parliament vote, it's exactly at the moment congressmen vote or women vote, it's not only a question of TTIP. I mean, when you're a political person, you vote, you represent your constituents. If your constituents have worries about other policies towards the U.S., well, that will be part of your whole assessment of the situation. So we may have, and I hope everything will go well, but my understanding of the situation at the moment in the Parliament, we'll see with the next one, where I believe it will be the same, or even worse, or more. If we don't try to solve other issues that are not TTIP, not trade, but other issues like data, we may have problems on the long term. Accession of other countries in the next, what most observers say in Brussels, and I believe it's true, is that we may have some Balkans countries joining the EU in the next years, maybe not immediately, but in the coming 10 years, let's say. Big countries, probably not. And why so? Because we are, and this is something that is not always perceived here in the US, the EU is not a vague commercial thing. It's not only about security, it's a political process. And this is why these elections are important. What we are doing is, it's a political process. We want to have a closer ever union. That means we are trying, but some people don't agree with that, but that's what we are trying. That's what the mainstream is trying to do. So it's already quite difficult with 28 countries. If we add big countries like Ukraine,
Exit rather than accession.
Ah, sorry. We'll see. I mean, if you know, the EU is not a prison. So any country which wants to leave, I would be sad and I would cry. But at the same time, if any member states want to leave, now it is organized in the Treaty of Lisbon. So if you don't like the EU, you don't have to stay in the EU. It's a democratic choice. I think it's quite good to know that. I mean, if you don't like it, just go away. I mean, it's a pity, but it is not a jail. We are together, we agree on laws. If you don't like it, you don't want to be part of the club anymore. Well, we are sorry because we loved you, but, that's your choice. So that's my take on that.
Yeah, Bruce, two fingers and we'll pee on it.
Just wanted to point out to people, if you're interested in Twitter and are on Twitter, we released yesterday an analysis of Twitter conversations about the election. I would say there were two findings that stuck out. One was mention of UKIP or the Front National far exceeds mention of the other parties in the UK by 2-1. So at least among those people who are on Twitter, there's a lot more mention of the far right than now. You should understand, this is not a science, it's not a representative sample. It's the people who are on Twitter obviously don't represent anything other than the people on Twitter. The second is that despite the good efforts of the establishment in Europe to, for the first time ever, it seems to me, to run candidates, for president of the commission and to highly publicize this, because if you're in Europe, you'll see Martin Schulz's, you know, face on posters. The mention of any of the candidates is actually infinitesimal on Twitter, at least on Twitter, which suggests that there's still a lot of work to do in terms of broadening the kind of perception of this as a European-wide selection.
Thank you. Pia, come on up. You can give us the benediction here, and we'll get everyone out. Yeah, that's true.
So thank you, first of all, Heather, Bruce, Heather, Olaf, Antoine, for a fantastic discussion, a timely discussion. I've learned a lot, as I always have. I think I wonder if the combined onslaught of what Mr. Putin is doing and the populist right-wing parties and then their combined efforts, you know, apparently they are finding each other attractive for various reasons. I wonder if that is going to make us rethink, I think Olaf already mentioned this, the value of what we have built and the fact that it's not just there. You know, unless we're willing in a stormy night to go out and fix the roof when it needs to be fixed, that we cannot just inherit what others have built for us, but that we have to do what it takes to keep it and to make sure that it is a good house to live in, that it fulfills the basic promises. I think it's always completely wrong. I never liked the discourse in Europe that somehow it was the project of a past generation and it doesn't speak to young people. I think it does. I think that we now need the EU. We will always need it, because the EU is absolutely essential for keeping the naturally occurring differences in interest that are there between people inheriting or living in the same space below a certain conflict threshold. And I think this is always going to be essential and needs to be filled with new life as we respond to a changing world. I also want to use this to say thank you and goodbye. I think if, like me, in the last couple of years, you've had the incredible good luck and privilege to work on issues you really care about, to work for an organization you really care about, and to work with people you really care for, then you are as lucky as can be. So I have been extremely lucky. Thank you for a wonderful cooperation with all of you sitting here. We have had various forms in which we have worked together. I feel quite good because I know that the office in Washington is in extraordinarily good hands. It's my colleague, Michael Meyer. Maybe you should get up so you can see him. Michael is currently still the head of the Ebert Foundation in Turkey. He brings that experience, extensive experience in a key region that is also very important in Washington politics. He was also in the headquarters, head of the Department for Europe and North America. He has extensive experience also in Africa, and he's just a wonderful person. So you will enjoy working with him very much, I know that. And all the best of luck, and I hope, very much hope, that our path will cross again. Thanks.
Thank you all for joining us. Stay tuned. We'll keep following the story. Thank you.